to Mark chapter 4 tonight, or let's go to Mark chapter 4. Before we get into it, I have an announcement and a confession. It's not too serious, not too big deal. We're starting tonight with chapter 4, verse 35. Okay? Chapter 4, verse 35? Yeah, okay, I thought you'd find it sooner or later. We stopped at 20. And what happened to 21 and down through 34? I forgot to study. There's always a sequence going when you come to a passage and you know you've got two deadlines. One is the deadline when you come to feel like you have a satisfactory understanding of what the passage says. And second is the deadline for teaching. The desired intent is always arrive at the deadline of understanding before you arrive at the deadline to teach. And on these parables, the deadline to teach tonight has been reached before I feel like I have a grasp of why did he put these parables here. For example, you've just had down through verse 20 something about the sowing of the seed. And then suddenly in verse 21, he was saying to them, a lamp is not brought to be put under a peck measure, or is it under a bed? Is it not brought to be put on a lampstand? For nothing is hidden except to be revealed, nor has anything been secret, but that it should come to light. And the little parable gives me two problems. Number one, how does it fit in context? Why did Jesus all of a sudden go from the idea of sowing and the good ground and the poor ground, then suddenly Mark turns to this passage about the lampstand not being hidden but predominantly displayed? And that is Mark's reason, because the other Gospels don't necessarily put it here. So this is his arrangement. And of course, you'd want to answer, if you're going to do well with the book, why did Mark, in the purpose of his book, put this particular parable right here? Then the second problem you've got is, what does it mean? When you come to verse 21, it says a lamp, and that's not what the Greek says. It says the lamp. And when you get to the word is not brought, it is the word erkamai, which doesn't mean to bring. It means to come. And so literally, the lamp has not come to be put under a peck measure, is it, or under a bed? Is Christ referring to himself? Is he the lamp? We've got to have a particular lamp, not just a general lamp. So is he talking about himself? That would fit with the fact that it is the lamp. It would also fit with the fact that the lamp has come to be put under not to be put under a peck measure or under a bed. And therefore, this may be a messianic parable where he's talking about himself and that nothing is hidden except to be revealed. He's talking about himself. Is that I have come to make myself known as to who I am and so forth. I'm not sure of that yet. So if you'll just hang on till Sunday, I'll try to come up with something along that line. But I do not like to teach when I'm not sure of what I'm saying. And I'll be very frank with you. I'm at the point in these particular parables down through this verse that I'm not sure what I'm saying. And I think you'd rather have that than something that I don't feel comfortable with as far as interpretation. I do feel comfortable with the next. And I think we can take this next section of Mark and simply call it Realms of Jesus' Sovereignty, extending through Mark 4, 34, down to the end of chapter 5, verse 43. And to back off and look at the realms, there are four. First of all, Jesus is sovereign over nature. Jesus is sovereign over nature. Mark 4, 34 through 41. And if you'll note in this section, this is the narrative of getting out in the Sea of Galilee. An enormous storm comes up, and the Lord speaks to the wind, and he speaks to the storm, and it subsides. He is sovereign over nature. Second, and this is chapter 5, verses 1 through 20, Jesus is sovereign over demons. The unseen evil world. Chapter 5, 1 through 20. And we'll have the demons arguing that you are granted, you are sovereign, please leave us alone. And by that there is admission, and he will cast them out. One thing you might note, look at your text and notice how long this is. 5, 1 through 20 has to do with the casting out of a demon. This is the most extended passage that we have describing demonic activity and giving us some idea of what it is. You even come down to something like verse 3, and notice in 3, 4, and 5, in previous context it simply says he cast out demons, but notice the detail. In verse 3, this man has been dwelling among the tombs. No one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gnashing himself with stones. So you have a rather detailed description that you simply do not have elsewhere. We may get into a bit of that tonight. But the point is, Jesus is going to be sovereign over demons. Third, Jesus is sovereign over death. And that concept will be split up between chapter 5, verse 21 through 24, and 35 through 43. And the reason it is split this way is when you come down to verse 21 of chapter 5, when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered about him, and he stayed on the seashore. And one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and upon seeing him, fell at his feet. And down through verse 24, he informs him of his daughter, who is about to die and at the point of death. Then notice that's interrupted at verse 25, because as he moves toward the house of Jairus, he meets the woman who had a hemorrhage for 12 years, and that extends 25 down through 34. And then notice at 35, it picks up again after he heals her with the arrival of Jairus saying that his daughter has been healed. So you have Jesus sovereign over death, 5:21 through 24, and picked up again in 35 through 42. Then sandwiched in between is another miracle, and that is the woman with the hemorrhage, and this shows Jesus is sovereign over disease. He heals her. And that would be in 5:25 through 42. 25 through 34, rather. So notice in all of these instances that follow down through the end of chapter 5, the complete control of Jesus over all of these realms, the unseen spiritual evil realms of Satan and demons, nature itself, death, and all of that which leads to death, namely disease. And the emphasis in all of them, Jesus vanquishes every one of them and is seen in absolute control. That's why we've called this section Realms of Jesus' Sovereignty. So let's begin tonight with the first one. Jesus is sovereign over nature. First case, Jesus is sovereign over nature, or sovereignty over nature. Chapter 4, 35 through 41. First of all, notice that in the report of chapter 4, you have all of the marks of an eyewitness account. All the marks that Mark didn't hear this from somebody else, he saw it himself. It is an eyewitness account. It is firsthand. This is not Mark's report of what Matthew or Luke or someone else has told him. Now, what are some of the remarks here that show that this is an eyewitness remark? Several things. First of all, notice in verse 35, he recalls the exact day and the time of day. Because in verse 35, on that day, which would be the day when Jesus taught all of those parables, when evening had come, So Mark is showing that this is not something passed on to me. I remember the day. I remember the part of the day. The second evidence of that is down at verse 36. Can you see a detail in that that you would not likely remember if you hadn't been there? Verse 36 says, "And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them just as he was." Sounds kind of eyewitness, doesn't it? Almost as though Mark is saying, he didn't even prepare. He didn't shave. Didn't change any clothing. They took him just like he was at the end of that day in the boat. And then notice the last detail that would point to an eyewitness. And other boats were with him. And if that story had been simply passed on to Mark from someone else, most likely those little details would have been omitted and would not. This is an eyewitness account. Notice the vivid detail in verse 37. "There arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much, the boat that was already filling up." And you can sense that he was there. The detail about the precise location of where Jesus was in verse 38. "And he was in the stern, asleep on a cushion." And those are all details that are saying we have an account that is dependable because it is an account of one that was there. All right, second, let's focus on the storm. Now, we have to use some imagination tonight to get into this. Verse 37 begins to talk about the storm. First of all, it would help to have a little bit of understanding of geography. If you've seen the Sea of Galilee, you know that when you look at it, it's literally a cup, because it's surrounded all the way around with very, very steep hills and mountains. In other words, it's like a basin. As a matter of fact, it's not like a basin. Galilee is a basin. It's a bowl. And coming down due to the terrain of the mountains and so forth and the hills, Galilee is known for some enormously fierce storms that occur on that particular lake. As a matter of fact, it's for that reason that they usually didn't fish till night, because you had these winds in the daytime and fierce storms, and by and large it was better just to get to the time of day when the wind has calmed down and fish in the evening. That also points out how bad this storm must have been. It was evening time. It was night. And they had a rare occurrence of a severe storm. The severity of it is also emphasized by noting the fact that these men who were experienced sailors, they were fishermen. That was their trade. They were terrified. You know, you figure when the TWA captain is in a panic, we must be in trouble. Because, you know, he's been through lots of this. And when I remember from flying, you several things you never do. You never say, "Oops." You never tap on an instrument, you know, to see if it's working. You don't do those things. It terrifies someone who is, and you don't come in and say, "Would you mind in the back seat to pull out the manual and turn to the passage that talks about landing?" Consequently, here you've got disciples who are experienced sailors. And in the midst of this, they are so terrified that they turn to a carpenter for help. And so that shows the terror that was there. They were absolutely convinced that they were in the process of sinking. Coming down to verse 38 in our translation has pretty well brought it out for us. "He himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and they woke him and said, 'Teacher, do you not care that we are," present tense, "in the process of perishing right now?" Present tense, verb, perishing. They felt that it was all occurring right now. That's the storm. So picture experienced sailors, absolutely terrified, convinced that we've had it, we're not going to make it, and these are men that have been in many a storm, and they're terrified by it. So the emphasis is the severity of the storm. Very severe. Couple that with the fact that it was the unusual time of day to have a storm. Third, after we look at that, the next thing that enters the picture is the enormous contrast. And the contrast enters into the picture at verse 38. And in order to give us the emphatic one single word, and there is one single word that is emphatic in Greek, the English has given us two words. The emphatic pronoun autos, A-U-T-O-S. And I'll put with that emphatic. And autos gets translated he himself. Notice our translators, in order to get across the emphasis, gave us two words instead of one. So the stress would be he himself was in the stern. And so the autos sets up the contrast. The contrast is double. First of all, the contrast looks at his condition versus the disciples. It's a double contrast. Jesus versus disciples. They are sweating and he is sleeping. They are terrified. He's sawing logs. And so it is the contrast then between terror on their part and peace on his part. And Mark is getting across that he was asleep when we were terrified. So it's a double contrast, first of all, between Jesus and his disciples. It is also a contrast with the rage of the storm. Jesus versus the disciples, Jesus versus the storm. When they awake him, he said, I'm utterly shocked. I'm sorry. I didn't know what was happening. And he joins them in their fear. Not at all. As a matter of fact, when they wake him up, he is neither surprised nor afraid. When Jesus is wakened, he is neither surprised. He does not apologize and say, I'm sorry I put you through this, but I was exhausted and I didn't realize what was happening. He is not surprised or afraid. Neither one. And all that is introduced by the word in verse 38, emphatic pronoun, he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, in contrast to them. And then verse 39, he, being aroused, rebuked the wind and said to it, hush, be still. So the contrast is the next thing we enter into the picture. Now, the disciples reveal something that Mark does uniquely. Mark, more than any other gospel, records the weakness and the failure of the disciples. But here is a first insight into some of their personality, and let's call that the impertinence of the disciples. Because on several occasions, they were just that. And it's in verse 38. Doesn't come across too clearly in our English translation. Verse 38 says, he himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. They awoke him and said to him, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? Now, we may not get the flavor that the Greek text has of impertinence at that point, but I think it's really well picked up by the translation of Moffat. And Moffat gives an excellent paraphrase for that. It is this. Teacher, are we to drown for all you care? That's kind of impertinent, isn't it? Are we to drown for all you care? That is not a very reverent answer. And we might trace out several other times when Mark notes that the disciples often were impertinent. Let's list them and then look at them. It's in 5:31, 6:37, and 8:4. What we're saying is that Mark notes that the disciples on occasion got a little bit mouthy. Chapter 5, verse 31. Jesus is passing through the crowd, and in verse 30, immediately Jesus, verse 28, he's in a crowd, and the woman thinks, if I just touch his garments, I shall get well. And immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. And immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, who touched my garments? And the disciples get wise mouth. Verse 31. Disciples said to him, "You see the multitude pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?' I mean, what's wrong with you? And there are people all over the place." And it was a little bit mouthy on their part. 637. It's good to know the disciples occasionally got mouthy and were still used by God, because we get mouthy sometimes. 637. They're out in the countryside, and the Lord says, "Give the people something to eat." This is verse 37. And they get a little bit smart-mouthed, don't they? They said to him, "Shall we go and spend money that we don't have on bread and give them something to eat? Now, where in the world do you think we're going to pull this food out of? We don't have the money to do it." Then chapter 8 and verse 4. And again, it's a setting where they're isolated from any food source. And the Lord talks about their hunger, and they get a little bit wise-mouthed about it. And they say in verse 4, "Where will anyone be able to find enough to satisfy these men with bread here in the middle of the Sahara?" And that's the tone that's there. So you do have, on the part of the disciples, a bit of impertinence that Mark records. Now, we might say one other thing about that impertinence. If you notice, in every one of those contexts, why were they impertinent? And the answer is simple. In every case, they were impertinent because they did not understand who he was. So that was rooted in failure to understand who Jesus was. So we'll note the impertinence was rooted in failure to know the character of Jesus, who he really was. Okay, following that, in verse 39, let's caption it, "The Drama." Because this is truly a dramatic event. Chapter 5, verse 39, Mark introduces the drama. 439, rather. 439, the drama. And the drama is found two places. It's found in Jesus' words, what he says, and it is found in nature's response. And they're both dramatic. I hope we'll be able to find it. First of all, it is found in what Jesus says in verse 39. "Being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea," two words, "Seopa," hush. And the word seopo is a Greek word that means be silent. It is also in present tense, which involves continuous action. Be silent and stay that way. Be silent and stay that way. The second word that is translated after hush is the word be still. And you have probably heard it explained before that the word be still is the Greek word for be muzzled. And the word be muzzled is found in the perfect tense. And the idea is be muzzled once and for all. A one-time action. So you can sense the drama. You're in the midst of a raging storm. You're absolutely convinced we are going to drown. We are drowning right now. And the Lord stands up and says, addressing the storm, be silent, stay that way, be muzzled once and for all. And then the drama follows in the action of nature, or in nature's response. And that comes down to the latter part of verse 39. "And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm." And the action is described with an aorist tense. Aorist is used for, we often diagram an aorist as a dot. A present tense is a line because it's going on. Perfect tense as an event with results coming out of it. The aorist tense is military. It's the sudden action. It's the immediate action that is involved. So the aorist points to instantaneous. It points to the instantaneous. It was not a matter of Peter or Mark in the boat saying, "Hey, I think we can relax a little bit. It seems to be getting better." Wetting the finger and sticking it up and saying, "It's not quite as windy as it was. It's dying down." And if you look over there, you can see a little bit of the sky breaking through. It was a matter of hush, be still, and like that, instantaneous type thing. Can you imagine being there in the midst of that? All right, six, the impact. What effect did it have? Verses 40 and 41. And the impact is made up of two things. An objective rebuke by Jesus of the apostles or disciples, and a subjective question on their part. So first of all, an objective rebuke. Verse 40. And he said to them, "Why are you so timid or afraid? How is it that you have no faith?" I think the thing to note about that is notice the rebuke of their fear and their lack of faith has no qualification to it. So notice the rebuke is unqualified. You shouldn't be afraid, period. You have lacked faith, period. The rebuke is not qualified in any way. Now, here's what I mean by that. Let's qualify it, then you'll see the difference. Notice that Jesus does not say, "Why are you so timid? I'm in the boat." Doesn't say that, does he? Why doesn't he say, "You shouldn't be afraid, you shouldn't be timid, because your Heavenly Father won't let you drown"? Have you forgotten that? Notice there is no qualification whatsoever. So let's put down this. They should not fear, even if he wasn't in the boat. They should not fear, even if he wasn't there. That's what we mean. It was not qualified in any way. It is, why are you afraid? And it is not, "Why are you afraid? God will take care of you. Why are you afraid? I'm here." It's, "Why are you afraid?" period. And that would point to the fact that there should be no fear on their part, even if he were not in the boat. Are they going to have to learn that the Lord's protection is not dependent on the Lord's physical presence? The last words of the book of Matthew are, "Lo," you can finish it, can't you? "I am with you even to the end of the age." They're going to need to learn. And his parting remarks will be that you've got to understand that I'm present even when I'm not physically present. And so they're going to have to be weaned away from the physical presence of the Lord, which they will be in time. And this could very well be a little prelude to that, that they're responsible for recognizing his presence even though it may not be there physically, or it may be there physically. Notice, I want to take a step further. They should not fear even if he was not there. Should we say this? They should not be afraid even if they perished. You've got to say that. They should not fear even if they perished. And again, if he had not meant that, he could have easily said, "Why are you so timid? I won't let you perish, or your Father won't let you perish." And, you know, that is important because we have no promise as believers that we will not perish in a catastrophe just because we belong to the Lord, do we? Christians are exempt from automobile accidents because God takes care of them. Christians only breathe their last in bed. You relate that to the reality of life. Christians can die in any number of ways. And the disciples could have drowned, and we don't know how all of them died, but There's no promise in the Word of God that says, I will keep you from having a car accident, drowning in the lake, falling out of a building, or being beaten to death. All of those things may happen to believers. We don't have exemption from it. We do have a promise, though, that to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Therefore, it applies. We do not need to fear. Now, notice in this little rebuke here of the lack of faith and the lack of fear, let's put down another point, and that's this. No gospel writer, Matthew, Luke, and John, is as open in describing the weakness of the disciples as Mark is. So the observation, Mark records the lapses and weakness of the disciples more than any other book. That's not saying anything negative about John or Matthew or Luke. It's just simply saying that Mark is a little bit more straightforward in pointing out their weaknesses. Now, let's list out the passages, then we'll go to them. 6:52, 7:18, 8:17 and 18, 8:33, 9:6, 9:19, 9:32, 9:34, 10:24, 10:32, 10:35, 14:40. Wow. He's not hesitant to point out their lapses. All right, now let's take and read each one. The first, the first is this one here. It's, why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith? 6:52. And we need to pick up a little context. One verse back ought to do it. 51. He, Jesus, got in the boat with them, and the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished. And Mark stops to note the weakness of the disciples. For they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, that their heart was hardened. That's a sad comment on the disciples, but it's encouraging. How many times in life do we have to look and say, as believers, we didn't gain any insight, did we? We just didn't have it. And that was true of these men. The Lord did not give up on them, and they became great men. So the weakness that is there is a reality. They had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. 7:18. Getting into this point, I think, is one of the reasons I like Mark. I guess you like people that identify with you, and I love people that are human and have a particular distaste for those who never have any problem, never yell at their wife or their husband, and just generally get along wonderfully all of the time. And I always want to say, unreal. Okay, 7:18. The Lord again, well, let's get verse 17. When leaving the multitude, he entered the house. His disciples questioned him about the parable, and he said to them, are you too so uncomprehending, thick-headed? Do you not see that whatever goes into the man from outside cannot defile him, and so forth? Notice he's noting the weaknesses of the disciples, and Mark records it. Chapter 8, verse 17. Mark is saying repeatedly that we were knuckleheads many, many times. And so, verse 17, they were talking about having no bread, and Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not see or understand? Do you have a hardened heart, having eyes but do not see, having ears, do not hear, and do you not remember? Can you identify with knowing doctrine and forgetting it in a crisis situation? Didn't have any supper. No yum-yums. And again, in this big hassle, after all of the things he's done for them, and he says, why can't you remember? Okay, chapter 8, verse 33. Here's the rebuke of Peter. Turning around, seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, for you're not setting your mind on God's interests, but on man's. 9:6. For he did not know what to answer, for they, the disciples, became terrified. 9:19. Mark particularly emphasizes the weakness and the failures of the disciples. Verse 19, he answered them and said, O unbelieving generations, and this is speaking to the disciple, O unbelieving generations, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me. Direct address to the disciples. And can you identify with Jesus saying to you or to me, how long must I put up with you? And he said it to the disciples. 32, but they did not understand this statement, and they were afraid to ask him. Verse 34, they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Uplifting conversation. 10:24. Man, it really puts out hope for us, doesn't it? 10:24, and the disciples were amazed at his words, but Jesus answered and said to them, children, how hard is it to enter into the kingdom of God? Verse 32, and they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them, and they were amazed. And those who followed were fearful. Then down at verse 35, James, John, and the sons of Zebedee came up to him, saying to him, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. 40. And this is in Gethsemane. He asked them to stay awake, and again he came, found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. Okay, Mark records more of the lapses of the disciples than any other to show these were real men with real weakness, with really thick heads, and asked some really dumb questions, and did some very foolish things, and really didn't seem to absorb truth at all. We should never give up. There's always hope. That's the objective rebuke. Notice this also results in the next verse in a subjective question. Objective rebuke, and now subjective questions. And that's in Mark 4, verse 41. And they became very much afraid and said to one another, who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? And note, there's no answer, is there? It simply says that was in the forefront of their mind and was there. Now, let's turn, having gone through the incident, to the doctrine involved here, because there is some major doctrine involved in this event. And the doctrine involved is twofold. First of all, there's a doctrine involved concerning the control of nature. And second, the doctrine is involved about the condition of nature. So there's a doctrine involved here about the control of nature. And second, we will find there is a lesson here about the condition of nature. First of all, there's a doctrine here about the control of nature. And I'll make two notes, and then we'll see them in passages. In the Old Testament, one of the ways that the sovereignty of God was shown was in the stilling of the sea. In the Old Testament, God's sovereignty was seen in the stilling of the sea. It was regarded as the sovereign act of God. And second, in the Old Testament, God's sovereignty was seen in the silencing of the wind. Two places then, two things we want to note doctrinally from the Old Testament. And we'll underline the key words, stilling of sea, silencing of wind. And when the Old Testament marvels and teaches how sovereign Yahweh is, it says, look at the way He stills the sea. Look at the way He silences the wind. And you have, in the context of what we have just looked at, Jesus silencing the wind and stilling the sea. And they end the chapter by saying, who is this man? Now keep in mind, they had an Old Testament mentality. They understood these concepts that we've just mentioned here that were in the Old Testament. And don't you think they reflected back? The Old Testament talked about Yahweh controlling the wind. This man controls the wind. Who is he? The Old Testament talked about how Yahweh stilled the sea. This man just stilled the sea. Who is he? Can you see what would go on in their mentality? Now, since probably we do not want to trust the fact that you are so aware that the Old Testament taught these two concepts that you can fill in passages underneath. Am I assuming something wrong? We better fill in some passages. Go, first of all, to Job 12. Job 12. This is Old Testament mentality concerning the sovereignty of God. Job 12, 15. And again, he is talking about God. And in verse 15, it says, behold, He, God, restrains the waters. Notice His sovereign control is expressed in the idea that He restrains waters and they dry up. He sends them out and they inundate. He is the sovereign controller of the absence of and the coming of rain or water. Psalm 33. Psalm 33. And verse 7. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deeps in storehouses. Notice His control of the waters. Who is the He in verse 7? Verse 6, by the word of, notice the caps, Yahweh. How do you explain that what Yahweh could do in the Old Testament, Jesus can do in the New? He is assigned identical powers with Yahweh. Chapter 65 and verse 7. A good study would be the actions of Jesus in the New Testament that are attributed to Yahweh in the Old Testament, and then present them to our Jehovah Witness friends. It's a good study, very thorough study could be made on that. 65:7. In verse 5, He said, by awesome deeds Thou dost answer us in righteousness, O God of our salvation. Verse 7. Who, God, doth still the roaring seas? And if I go back to the disciples' question, what kind of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey Him? Well, the Old Testament tells us what kind of man He is. He is deity. Because it is deity in the Old Testament that control the sea. So verse 7, who, God, does still the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves? Psalm 77, 16. Psalm 77, 16. The waters saw Thee, O God. The waters saw Thee, and they were in anguish. And it's the control of God over the waters. The Old Testament presents God's sovereignty as seen in the stilling of the sea and control of the waters. In the Old Testament, God's sovereignty was seen as the silencing of the wind, and let's substantiate that also with some passages, and the first one we should go to would be Job 28. Their question is, when they have seen the miracle, they have no question but what has happened. The question is, what kind of man can do this? And the answer coming from the Old Testament is God. Job 28:24. For he, reference to God, go back to verse 23 for that, he looks to the ends of the earth, sees everything under the heavens. When he imparted weight to the wind, meted out the waters by measure, when he set a limit for the rain, and that's certainly what Jesus did there, and a course for the thunderbolt, then he saw and declared it, he established it, and he searched it out. Psalm 107. Psalm 107. Verses 25 through 30. This is an extensive but a beautiful passage. Verse 25. Speaking of the Lord, and it's speaking of Yahweh, verse 24 says, they have seen the works of Yahweh, and his wonders in the deep. For he, Yahweh, spoke and raised up a stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They rose up to the heavens, they went down to the depths. Their soul melted away in their misery. They reeled and staggered like a drunken man. And can you imagine with all the imagery, with all those high waves, all of a sudden they just recede? And the psalmist describes that receding like here they were splashing in every direction, like a drunken man, and were at their wit's end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble. He brought them out of their distress. He caused the storm to be still. This is Yahweh. And as the disciples had just seen, he says, hush, be still, permanently. And having seen it sitting there in the middle of Galilee, they asked themselves, who is this man? And if their mentality went to the Old Testament, we would find out in verse 29 that he, God, Yahweh, caused the storm to be still so that the waves of the sea were hushed. And they were glad because they were quiet, so he guided them to the desired haven in verse 30. And it almost as though it's written for the event that we have just looked at. Psalm 147, 18. Just a shorter one, but speaking of the Lord, he, and this again is Yahweh, he sends forth his word and melts them. He causes his wind to blow and waters to flow. Control over nature. All right, then, that is our first doctrine involved, then, coming out of this miracle. But there's a second doctrine involved, and it is about the condition of nature. About the control of nature, about the condition of nature. When we think of nature, we need to think of four things about it. In other words, this is the way we view nature. We should think of nature as, number one, it is God's creation. This is let's put this down. This is Christian ecology. We talked a lot about ecology today, and Christians have something to say. This is simply Christian ecology. First of all, he looks at creation, looks at nature as God's creation. I'll just put down Genesis 1. You know that. Second, when we look at nature, not only do we view it as God's creation, but we need to see man's responsibility to it. Go to Genesis 1:28. Genesis 1:28. Christian ecology looks at nature and recognizes that this is God's creation. He also looks at nature and recognizes that he has a responsibility. In 1:28, God blessed them. God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Notice the simple point that man had a responsibility toward nature. Now, when you look at that, however, that leaves a very difficult concept because we certainly don't do all that good of job of subduing nature. And I've never heard of anybody that ruled a fish. And I know nobody ever rules a cat. So everything is fine to this point. It's clear that God made it, and God says you're responsible for it, but you need to put another piece into the picture. And that is recognize the fact that nature is also sin's victim. Romans 8:20. When the ecologist comes along and says there's something wrong in the way we're treating nature out here and there's something wrong with all of this, we can give them an answer. The same thing is wrong with nature that's wrong with man, sin. They won't buy that, but nonetheless, it's a biblical perspective. Chapter 8, verse 20. For the creation was subjected to futility. And even though you work with it and it's nice, but isn't it interesting the way the weeds grow and the tomatoes don't? And I opportunity to work in an announcement. Doris Davis says she has left some cucumbers downstairs and at the front door. Okay. I just think this tape will go everywhere. There'll be people in California and what have you asking for your cucumbers. So verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but because of him who subjected it, and so forth. So we need to remember it is sin's victim. But to complete the picture, there's one other thing. Isn't God going to do anything about it? And therefore, in viewing nature, we must take a look at Christ's redemption, which extends not only to man, body, soul, and spirit, but which also extends to nature. And if you read that in chapter 8, verse 21, that the creation itself also will be set free. There's a day of redemption coming. From its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And not only this, but we also ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly for the adoption of sons, the redemption of our bodies. So when we view, as Christians, ecology or nature, we begin with the Creator God who made it, the responsibility of man to rule it, then the reality that it is because of man's sin become the victim of sin itself, Romans 8:20, and then recognize that ultimately there's a freedom for us in glorification and there's an ultimate freedom for nature in ultimate redemption, all flowing from Christ. And like in all things, it's inevitable pattern of Scripture that man presents the problem and God always comes up with the solution. And the solution is always that which centers in himself and in his honor and in his glory. All right, that prepares us now for our next study, which will be Jesus is Sovereign Over Demons, most extended passage in the New Testament, Mark 5:1-20. And our Father, as we close tonight, we give you thanks for your word. We're so grateful that you choose a man like Mark who sets in front of us all of the weaknesses of the disciples, men who under your tutelage and your instruction became great men, men who even wrote Scripture, and who become the foundation of the church. And When we see that, as Ephesians teaches us, that the church is built on the foundation of the apostles and ultimately the chief cornerstone of Jesus Christ Himself, we are encouraged when you speak to these pillars of the church and at one time in their life said, "How could you be so stupid? How long do I have to put up with you? How can you be so unperceptive?" We're thankful that your word does not glorify its heroes, but it gives their good points and it also is honest in that it shares the weaknesses of all the men that you use. And we're thankful for that tonight in Christ's name.